window. There is another bedroom next door. Smaller, but a bedroom nonetheless. I need longer to inspect, said Nell. I'll join you downstairs when I'm done. The agent seemed happy enough to be dismissed, and within a minute Nell saw her appear outside the front gate, huddling into her coat. Nell watched as the woman did battle with the wind to light a cigarette. Then she let her gaze drift down towards the garden. She couldn't see much from up here, had to look through a frayed tapestry of creepers, but she could just make out the stone head of the little boy statue. Nell leaned on the dusty window frame, felt the salt-roughened wood beneath her palms. She had been in this cottage before, as a child. She knew that now. She had stood at this very spot, in this room, watching the same sea. She closed her eyes and willed her memory into sharper focus. A bed had stood where she was now. A single bed, simple, with brass ends, dulled knobs that needed polishing. From the ceiling, an inverted cone of netting fell, like the white mist that hung from the horizon when storms were stirring the distant sea. A patchwork quilt, cool beneath her knees. Fishing boats bobbing on the tide. Flower petals floating on the pond below. Sitting in this window that jutted out from the rest of the cottage was like hanging from the top of the cliff. Like the princess in one of her favorite fairy tales, turned to a bird and left swinging in her golden cage. Raised voices downstairs. Her papa. And the authoress. Her name, Ivory, sharp and jagged like a star cut from cardboard with pointed scissors. Her name as a weapon. There were other angry words being hurled. Why was Papa shouting at the authoress? Papa, who never raised his voice. The little girl felt frightened. She didn't want to hear. Nell clenched her eyes tighter, tried to hear. The little girl blocked her ears, sang songs in her mind, told stories, thought about that golden cage, the princess bird swinging and waiting. Nell tried to push aside the child's song, the image of a golden cage. In the cold depths of her mind, the truth was lurking, waiting for Nell to clutch it and drag it to the surface. But not today. She opened her eyes. Those tendrils were too slippery today, the water around them too murky. Nell took herself back down the narrow stairs. The agent locked the gate, and together they started in silence down the path to where the car was parked. "So what did you think?" said the agent, in the perfunctory tone of one who thought she knew the answer. "I'd like to buy it. Perhaps there is something else I can..." The agent looked up from the car door. "You'd like to buy it?" Nell gazed again across the stormy sea, the misty horizon. She enjoyed a bit of inclemency in her weather. When the clouds hung low and rain threatened, she felt restored, breathed more deeply, thought more clearly. She had no idea how she'd pay for the cottage, what she'd have to sell in order to do so. But as sure as black and white made grey, Nell knew she had to own it. From the moment she'd remembered that little girl by the fish pond, the little girl who was Nell in a different lifetime, she'd known. The agent drove all the way back to the Tregenna Inn with breathless promises to walk round with the contracts just as soon as she had them typed up. She had the name of a good solicitor Nell could use, too. Nell closed the car door and went up the steps to the foyer. She was so intent on her attempt to calculate the time difference. Was it add 3 hours and change a.m. to p.m., so she could call her bank manager and attempt to explain the sudden acquisition of a Cornish cottage? She didn't see the person coming towards her until they almost collided. "I'm sorry," said Nell, stopping with a jolt. Robin Martin was blinking quickly behind her glasses. Were you waiting for me? Said Nell. I brought you something. Robin handed Nell a pile of papers clipped together. It's research for the article I've been working on about the Maltrichet family. She shifted awkwardly. I heard you asking Gump about them, and I know he wasn't able to... that he wasn't much help. She smoothed already smooth hair. It's an odd assortment, really. But I thought they might be of interest to you. Thank you, said Nell, meaning it. And I'm sorry if I... Robin nodded. Is your grandfather... much better. In fact, I was wondering whether you might come to dinner again, one night next week. At Gump's house. I appreciate you asking me, said Nell, but I don't think your grandfather will. Robin shook her head, hair swinging neatly. Oh, no. You've misunderstood. Nell's eyebrows lifted. It was his idea, said Robin. He said there was something he needed to tell you. About the cottage. And Eliza Makepeace. Chapter 34. New York and Tregenna, 1907. Miss Rose Mountrachet, Cunard Liner, Lusitania. The 9th of September, 1907, Miss Eliza Mountrachet, Blackhurst Manor, Cornwall, England. My dearest Eliza, oh, what wonder the Lusitania! As I write this letter, cousin of mine, I am seated on the upper deck, a dainty little table on the veranda café, gazing out across the wide blue Atlantic as our great floating hotel spirits us towards New York. There is an atmosphere of tremendous celebration on board, with everyone positively overbrimming with hope that the Lusitania will take back the blue riband from Germany. At the landing stage in Liverpool, as the great ship moved slowly from her moorings and began proper her maiden voyage, the crowd on deck were singing, "Britons never, never shall be slaves," and waving flags, so many, and so quickly, that even as we pulled further away and the folk ashore were diminished into tiny dots, I could see the flags still moving. When the boats bade us farewell by tooting their horns, I confessed to goosebumps on my arms, and a sensation of swelling pride in my heart. What joy to be involved in such momentous events! Will history remember us, I wonder? I do hope so. To imagine that one might do something, touch an event somehow, and thereby transcend the bounds of a single human lifetime. I know what you will say with regards to the blue riband. That it's a silly race, invented by silly men trying to prove little more than that their boat can outrun that belonging to even sillier men. But dearest Eliza, to be here, to breathe the spirit of excitement and conquest, well, I can only say that it's invigorating. I feel more alive than I have done in an age, and though I know you will be rolling your eyes, you must allow me to profess my deepest wish that we do make the trip in record speed and win back our rightful place. The entire ship is appointed in such a way that it is difficult at times to remember that one is at sea. Mama and I are staying in one of the two regal suites on board. It comprises two bedrooms, a sitting room, dining room, private bath, lavatory, and pantry, and is beautifully decorated, reminding me a little of the pictures of Versailles in Miss Tranton's book, the one she brought to the schoolroom that summer long ago. I overheard a beautifully dressed lady commenting that it is more like a hotel than any ship she has ever before travelled aboard. I do not know who that lady was, but I feel sure she must be very important, for Mama suffered a rare bout of speechlessness when we found ourselves within her orbit. Never fear, 'twas not abiding. Mama cannot be repressed for long. She quickly found her tongue, and has been making up for lost time ever since. Our fellow passengers are a veritable who's who of London society, according to Mama, and thus they must be charmed. I am under strict instructions to be always at my best. Thank goodness I have two wardrobes full of armaments with which to dress for battle. For once Mama and I are of a mind, though certainly not of a taste. She is forever pointing out a gentleman she considers an excellent match, and I am frequently dismayed. But enough. I fear I will lose the audience of my dearest cousin if I tarry too long on such subjects. Back to the ship, then. I have been carrying out certain explorations, sure to make my Eliza proud. Yesterday morning I managed briefly to escape Mama and passed a lovely hour in the roof garden. I thought of you, dearest, and how amazed you would be to see that such vegetation could be grown on board a ship. There are tubs at every turn, filled with green trees and the most beautiful flowers. I felt quite joyous sitting amongst them. No one knows better than I the healing properties of a garden, and gave myself over to all kinds of silly daydreams. You will be able to imagine well enough the paths down which my fancies rambled. Oh, but how I wish you had relented and come with us, Eliza. I shall make time here for a brief but gentle scold, for I simply cannot understand. It was you, after all, who first raised the notion that the two of us might someday travel to America, witness firsthand the skyscrapers of New York and the great Statue of Liberty. I cannot think what induced you to forsake the opportunity so that you might stay at Blackhurst with only father for company. You are, as always, a mystery to me, dearest, but I know better than to argue with you when your mind is made up, my dear, stubborn Eliza. I will say only that I miss you already, and find myself frequently imagining how much mischief might be had were you here with me. How we would wreak havoc on poor Mama's nerves! It is strange to think upon a time when you were unknown to me. It seems we have always been a pair, and the years at Blackhurst before you arrived, but a horrid waiting period. Ah, Mama is calling. It seems we are expected yet again in the dining room. The meals, Eliza. I am having to stroll about the deck between times in order to stand any hope at all of making a polite attempt at the next sitting. Mama has no doubt managed to harpoon the Earl of so-and-so, or the son of some wealthy industrialist, as table-mate. A daughter's work is never done, and she is right in this. I shall never meet my fate if I keep myself locked away. I bid you good-bye, then, my dear Eliza, and close by saying that though you are not with me in person, you most certainly are in spirit. I know that when I first catch sight of the famed Lady of Liberty standing vigilant over her port, it will be my cousin Eliza's voice I hear, saying, "Just look at her and think of all she's seen." I remain always your beloved cousin, Rose. Eliza tightened her fingers around the brown paper-wrapped parcel. Standing on the doorstep of the Tregenna General Store, she watched as a dark grey blanket of cloud sagged towards the mirror below. Haze on the horizon spoke of storms at sea, and the air in the village vacillated with anxious flecks of moisture. Eliza had brought no bag, as when she'd left the house she hadn't intended a trip to the village. It was sometime during the morning that the story had crept up on her and demanded immediate description. The 5 pages left in her current notebook had been sorely inadequate, the need for a new one pressing. Thus had she embarked on this impromptu shopping expedition. Eliza glanced once more at the sullen sky and set off quickly along the harbour. When she reached the point where the road forked, she ignored the main branch and started instead up the narrow cliff track. She had never followed it before, but Davies had once told her that a short cut from the estate to the village ran along the cliff edge. The way was steep and the grass long, but Eliza proceeded apace. She paused only once to look out across the flat granite sea, on which a fleet of tiny white fishing boats was coming home to roost. Eliza smiled to see them, like baby sparrows returning to the nest, hurrying in after a day spent exploring the rim of a vast world. One day she would cross that sea, all the way to the other side, just as her father had done. There were so many worlds waiting beyond the horizon. Africa, India, Arabia, the Antipodes. And in such faraway places would she discover new stories, magical tales from long ago. Davies had suggested she write down her own tales, and write Eliza had. She'd filled 12 notebooks, and still she hadn't stopped. Indeed, the more she wrote, the louder the story seemed to grow, swirling in her mind, pressing against her head, anxious for release. She didn't know whether they were any good, and in truth she didn't care. They were hers, and writing them made them real somehow. Characters who danced around inside her mind grew bolder on the page. They took on new mannerisms she hadn't imagined for them, said things she didn't know they thought, began to behave unpredictably. Her stories had a small but receptive audience. Each night after supper, Eliza would crawl into bed beside Rose, just as she had when they were younger, and there she would begin her most recent fairy tale. Rose would listen, wide-eyed, gasping and sighing in all the right places, laughing gleefully at certain gruesome moments. It was Rose who had cajoled Eliza into sending one of her tales away to the London office of the Children's Storytime Journal. "Don't you want to see them in print? They will be real stories then, and you, a real writer. They're already real stories." Rose had taken on a slightly devious look. "But if they're published, you will earn a little income." An income of her own. This did interest Eliza, and Rose well knew it. Up until this point, Eliza had been fully dependent on her aunt and uncle, but lately she'd been wondering how she was going to fund the travels and adventures she knew the future held. "And it certainly wouldn't please Mama," said Rose, clasping her hands together beneath her chin, biting her lip to stop from smiling. "A Montrachet lady earning a living." Aunt Adeline's reaction, as always, meant little of consequence to Eliza. But the idea of other people reading her tales... Ever since Eliza had discovered the book of fairy tales in Mrs. Swindle's rag and bone shop, had disappeared inside its faded pages, she'd understood the power of stories, their magical ability to refill the wounded part of people. Mizzle was turning now to light rain, and Eliza began to run, hugging the notebook to her chest as wet strands of grass brushed against her damp skirt. What would Rose say when Eliza told her the Children's Journal was going to publish The Changeling, that they had asked to see more? She smiled to herself as she ran. A week to go before Rose was finally home, and Eliza could barely wait. How she longed to see her cousin! Rose had been rather remiss with correspondence. There had been one letter composed en route to America, but nothing since, and Eliza found herself waiting impatiently for news of the great city. She would have loved to visit it herself, but Aunt Adeline had been clear. "Ruin your own prospects, by all means," she said one evening when Rose had retired to bed, "but I will not allow you to ruin Rose's future with your uncivilized ways. She'll never meet her fate if she's not given opportunity to shine." Aunt Adeline had drawn herself to her full height. "I have booked 2 passages to New York, one for Rose and one for myself. I wish to avoid unpleasantness, thus it would be best if she thought the decision had been yours." "Why would I lie to Rose?" Aunt Adeline inhaled, and her cheeks hollowed. "To make her happy, of course. Don't you want her to be happy?" A thunderclap echoed between the cliff walls as Eliza reached the hilltop. The sky was darkening and the rain growing heavier. In the clearing stood a cottage. The same little cottage, Eliza realized, that crouched on the other side of the walled garden that Uncle Linus had given her to plant. She hurried to shelter beneath the entrance portico, huddled against the door as rain spilled thicker and faster over the eaves. It had been 2 months since Rose and Aunt Adeline had left for New York, and though time was dragging now, the first month had passed swiftly in a whirl of fine weather and splendid story ideas. Eliza had split each day between her two favorite places on the estate, the black rock down in the cove, on top of which millennia of tides had washed smooth a seat-sized platform, and the hidden garden, her garden at the end of the maze. What a delight it was to have a place of one's own, an entire garden in which to be. Sometimes Eliza liked to sit on the iron seat, perfectly still, and just listen to the wind-blown leaves tapping against the walls, the muffled ocean breathing in and out, and the birds singing their stories. Sometimes, if she sat still enough, she almost fancied she could hear the flowers sighing in gratitude to the sun. But not today. The sun had withdrawn, and beyond the cliff edge, sky and sea were merged in grey agitation. Rain continued to pour, and Eliza sighed. There was no point yet attempting to make her way to the garden and through the maze, not unless she wanted a thorough drenching for herself and her new notebook. If only a hollow tree could be found in which to shelter. A story idea began to flutter on the edge of Eliza's imagination. She snatched at it, refused to let it go, held on as it grew arms, legs, and a clear destination. She reached inside her dress and withdrew the lead pencil she always kept tucked beneath her bodice, leaned the new notebook against her bent knee, and began to scribble. The wind blew stronger up here in the realm of the birds, and rain had begun to swirl inside her hiding place, tossing splotches on her pristine pages. Eliza turned towards the door, but still the rain found her. This was no good. Where would she write when the wet weather set in for the season? The cove and the garden would not be fair shelter then. There was her uncle's house, of course, with its 100 rooms, but Eliza found it difficult to write when there was always someone nearby. It was possible to think oneself alone, only to discover a housemaid had been knelt by the fire, raking coals all the while, or her uncle, sitting silent in a dim, dark corner. A scud of heavy rain landed at Eliza's feet, drenching the portico. She closed the notebook and tapped her heel impatiently against the stone floor. She needed better shelter than this. Eliza glanced at the red door behind her. How had she not noticed before? Emerging from the lock was the ornate handle of a big brass key. Without further hesitation, Eliza twisted it to the left. The mechanism shifted with a clunk. She laid her hand on the doorknob, smooth and unaccountably warm, and turned it. A click, and the door was open, as if by magic. Eliza stepped across the threshold into the dark, dry womb. Beneath the black umbrella, Linus sat waiting. He hadn't caught a glimpse of Eliza all day, and agitation possessed his every mannerism. She would come, though. He knew that. Davy said she had intended to visit the garden, and there was only one way back from there. Linus allowed his eyes to close, and his mind to fall backwards through the years to a time when Georgiana had disappeared daily into the garden. She had asked him again and again to come, to see the planting she had done, but Linus always declined. He had waited for her, though, kept vigil until his poupee reappeared each day from between the hedges. Remembered sometimes his entrapment by the maze all those years before. What an exquisite feeling it had been, the curious mélange of old shame mixed with joy at his sister's emergence. He opened his eyes and drew breath, thought at first he was subject to a wishful fantasy. But no, it was Eliza, coming this way and deep in thought. She hadn't seen him yet. His dry lips moved around the words he wished to speak. "Child," he called out. She looked up, surprised. "Uncle," she said, smiling slowly. She held her hands out to the side. In one was a brown package. "How sudden the rain!" Her skirt was wet, the transparent rim clinging to her legs. Linus couldn't look away.
I was afraid you might be caught in the weather.
And I very nearly was. I found shelter, though, in the cottage. The little cottage on the other side of the maze. Wet hair, wet hem, wet ankles.
Linus swallowed, dug his cane into the damp earth, and pushed himself to standing.
Is the cottage used by anyone, Uncle?
Eliza came closer.
It appeared unused.
Her smell. Rain, salt, soil. He leaned against his cane and almost fell. She reached to steady him.
The garden, child. Tell me of the garden. Oh, Uncle, how it grows. You must come one day and sit amongst the flowers. See for yourself the planting I have made.
Her hands on his arm were warm, her grip firm. He would give the remaining years of his life to stop time and remain forever in this moment, he and his Georgiana.
Lord Montrachet?
Thomas was flustering towards them from the house.
My lord, you should have said you needed help.
And then Eliza was no longer holding him. Thomas was in her place. And Linus could only watch as she disappeared up the stairs and into the entrance hall, paused fractionally at the stand to collect the morning's post before being swallowed by his house.
Miss Rose Mountrachet, Cunard Liner, Lusitania. The 7th of November, 1907. Miss Eliza Mountrachet, Blackhurst Manor, Cornwall, England. Dearest Eliza, what a time. So much has happened since last we met, I can barely think where to start. First, I must apologize for the dearth of letters in recent weeks. Our last month in New York was such a whirlwind, and when I first sat down to write to you, as we left the great American port, we fell victim to such a storm, I almost believed myself back in Cornwall. The thunder and, oh, the squalls! I was laid up in my cabin for a full 2 days, and poor Mama was quite green. She required frequent tending. What a turn-up it was! Mama ill, and sickly Rose, her nurse. After the storm finally subsided, the mist remained for many days, floating about the ship like a great sea monster. It put me in mind of you, dear Eliza, and the stories you used to spin when we were girls, about the mermaids and the ships lost at sea. The skies have cleared now as we draw ever closer towards England. But wait, why am I giving you weather reportage when I have so much else to relate? I know the answer to that. I am dancing around my true intentions, hesitating before giving voice to my real news. Oh, where to begin? You will remember, Eliza dear, from my last letter that Mama and I had made the acquaintance of certain important people. One, Lady Dudmore, turned out to be a person of some consequence indeed. What's more, it would seem she took a shine to me, for Mama and I were issued many a letter of introduction and were thus inducted into a circle of New York's finest society. What glittering butterflies we were, flitting from one party to another. But still I tarry, for you need not hear of every soiree, every game of bridge. Eliza, dearest, with no further ado, I will hold my breath and write it plain. I am engaged, engaged to be married. And dear Eliza, I am so bursting with joy and wonder that I hardly dare open my mouth to speak for fear I will have little to say except to gush about my love. And that I will not do. Not here. Not yet. I refuse to diminish these fine feelings through inadequate attempt to capture them in words. Instead, I will wait until we meet again and then tell you all.
Let it be enough, my cousin, to say that I am floating in a great and glittering cloud of happiness. I have never felt so well, and I have you to thank, my dear Eliza. From Cornwall, you have waved your fairy wand and granted me my dearest wish. For my fiancé, what thrill to write those two words, my fiancé, may not be what you imagine. Though in most everything he is of the highest order, handsome, clever, and good, in matters of finance, he is quite a poor man. And now you will begin to intuit just why I suspect you of the gift of prophecy. He is just as the match you invented for me in the changeling. How did you know, dearest, that I would have my head turned by such a one? Poor Mama is in a state of some shock, though improved somewhat by now. Indeed, she barely spoke to me for some days after I informed her of my engagement. She, of course, had her heart set on a greater match, and will not see that I care not one whit for money or title. Those are her desires for me, and while I confess I once shared them, I do so no longer. How can I when my prince has come for me and unlatched the door to my golden cage? I ache to see you again, Eliza, and to share with you my joy. I have missed you tremendously and can hardly bear to think that once I arrive in England, there will be yet another week to wait before we're together. I will post this letter as soon as we dock in Liverpool. Would that I were accompanying it directly to Blackhurst, rather than languishing in the dreary company of Mama's family. I remain yours, lovingly now and evermore, Cousin Rose. If she were honest, Adeline blamed herself. Had she not, after all, been present with Rose at each glittering event during their visit to New York? Had she not appointed herself chaperone at the ball given by Mr. and Mrs. Irving in their grand house on Fifth Avenue? Worse still, had she not given Rose a nod of encouragement when the dashing young man with dark hair and full lips made his approach and requested the pleasure of a dance? "Your daughter is a beauty," Mrs. Frank Hastings had said, leaning over to whisper in Adeline's ear as the handsome couple took to the floor. "Fairest of them all tonight." Adeline had shifted, yes, proudly, on her seat. Was that the moment of her undoing? Had the Lord noted her hubris? Beauty equaled by her purity of heart. "And Nathaniel Walker is a handsome man indeed." Nathaniel Walker. It was the first time she'd heard his name. "Walker," she said thoughtfully. The name had a solid ring to it. Surely she'd heard tell of a family called Walker who'd made their fortune in oil. New money, but times were changing. There was no longer any shame in a match of title with treasure. Who are his people? Did Adeline imagine the hint of barely concealed glee that briefly animated Mrs. Hastings' bland features? "Oh, no one of consequence." She raised one bald eyebrow. "An artist, you know, befriended most ludicrously by one of the younger Irving boys." Adeline's smile had grown stale around the edges, but still she held it. All was not yet lost. Painting was a perfectly noble hobby, after all. "Rumor has it," came Mrs. Hastings' crushing blow. "The Irving chappie met him on the street. Son of a pair of immigrants, Poles at that. Walker may be what he calls himself, but I doubt that's what was written on the immigration papers. I hear tell he makes sketches for a living."
"Oil portraits?"
"Oh, nothing so grand as that. Scratchy charcoal things, from what I understand."
She sucked in one cheek in an attempt to swallow her glee.
"Quite a rise, indeed. Parents are Catholics. Father worked on the wharves." Adeline fought the urge to scream as Mrs. Hastings leaned back against her gilt chair, face pinched at the edges by one of Schadenfreude's smiles.
No harm in a young girl dancing with a handsome man, though, is there?
A smooth smile to mask her panic.
No harm at all, said Adeline.
But how could she believe it when her mind had already tossed up the memory of a young girl standing atop a Cornish cliff, eyes wide and heart open, as she looked upon a handsome man who appeared to promise so much? Oh, there was harm indeed for a young lady flattered by the brief attentions of a handsome man. The week passed, and that was the best that could be said of it. Night after night, Adeline paraded Rose before an audience of suitable young gentlemen. She waited and she hoped, longing to see a spark of interest brighten her daughter's face. But each night, disappointment. Rose had eyes only for Nathaniel, and he, it seemed, for her. Like one in the grip of a dangerous hysteria, Rose was trapped and unreachable. Adeline had to fight the urge to slap her cheeks, cheeks that glowed more fervently than a delicate young woman's cheeks had any right to. Adeline, too, was haunted by Nathaniel Walker's face. At each dinner, dance, or reading they attended, she would scan the room, seeking him out. Fear had created a template in her mind, and all other faces were blurred, only his features clear. She began to see him even when he wasn't there. She had dreams of wharves and boats and poor families. Sometimes the dreams took place in Yorkshire, and her own parents played the part of Nathaniel's family. Oh, her poor addled brain! To think that she could be brought to this. Then one evening, the worst finally happened. They had been at a ball, and the entire carriage ride home, Rose was very quiet. The particular type of quiet, which presages a firming of heart, a clearing of view. Like someone nursing a secret, keeping it close for a time, before unleashing it to do its worst. The horrid moment came when Rose was dressing for bed.
"Mama," she said as she brushed her hair, "there's something I wish to tell you."
Then the words, the dreaded words, affection, fate, forever. "You are young," Adeline said quickly, cutting Rose off. "It is understandable that you should confuse friendship with affection of another kind."
"It isn't friendship alone that I feel, Mama."
Heat rose beneath Adeline's skin. "It would be a disaster. He brings nothing."
"He brings himself, and that's all I need."
Her insistence, her infuriating confidence.
"Evidence of your naivety, my Rose, and your youth."
"I am not too young to know my mind, Mama. I am 18 now. Did you not bring me to New York so that I might meet my fate?"
Adeline's voice was thin.
"This man is not your fate."
"How do you know that?"
"I am your mother."
How feeble it sounded.
"You are beautiful, from an important family, and yet you would settle for so little."
Rose sighed softly, in a way that seemed to signal a close to the conversation.
"I love him, Mama."
Adeline closed her eyes. Youth. What chance had the most reasonable arguments against the arrogant power of those three words? That her daughter, her precious prize, should utter them so easily, and about such a one as he.
"And he loves me, Mama. He told me so."
Adeline's heart tightened with fear. Darling girl, blinded by foolish thoughts of love. How to tell her that the hearts of men were not so easily won? If won, rarely kept.
"You'll see," Rose said. "I shall live happily ever after, just like in Eliza's story. She wrote this, you know. Almost as if she knew what would happen."
Eliza. Adeline seethed. Even here, at this distance, the girl continued her menace. Her influence extended across the oceans. Her ill-whispering sabotaged Rose's future, goaded her into making the biggest mistake of her life. Adeline pressed her lips together tightly. She hadn't overseen Rose's recovery from countless ailments and illnesses in order to watch her throw herself away on a poor marriage.
You must break it off. He will understand. He must have known it would never be allowed.
We are engaged, Mama. He has asked, and I have accepted him.
Break it off.
I will not. Adeline felt her back against the wall.
You will be shunned from society, unwelcome in your father's home.
Then I will stay here, where I am welcome, in Nathaniel's home.
How had it come to this? Her Rose saying such things. Things she must have known would break her mama's heart. Adeline's head was spinning. She needed to lie down.
I'm sorry, Mama, Rose said quietly, but I won't change my mind. I can't. Don't ask me to.
They didn't speak for days after, excepting, of course, such banal social pleasantries as would have been unthinkable for either of them to ignore. Rose thought Adeline was sulking, but she was not. She was deep in thought. Adeline had always been able to bend passion towards logic. The current equation was impossible. Thus, some factor must be changed. If it wasn't going to be Rose's mind, it would have to be the fiancé himself. He must become a man deserving of her daughter's hand, the sort of man people spoke about with awe, and, yes, with envy. And Adeline had a feeling she knew just how such a change might be effected. In each man's heart, there lies a hole. A dark abyss of need, the filling of which takes precedence over all else. Adeline suspected that Nathaniel Walker's hole was pride, the most dangerous pride, that of the poor man. A hunger to prove himself, to rise above his birth and make of himself a better man than his father. Even without the biography so greedily supplied by Mrs. Hastings, the more Adeline saw of Nathaniel Walker, the more she knew this to be true. She could see it in the way he walked, the careful shine of his shoes, the keenness of his smile, and the volume of his laugh. These were the traits of a man who had come from little and glimpsed the gleaming world swirling far above his own, a man whose finery was hung upon a poor man's skin. Adeline knew his weakness well, for it was her own. She also knew exactly what she had to do. She must ensure that he received every advantage. She must become his greatest champion, promote his art to the best in society, ensure that his name became synonymous with portraiture of the elite. With her ringing endorsement, with his good looks and charm, not to mention Rose for a wife, he couldn't fail to impress. And Adeline would make sure that he never forgot who was responsible for his good fortune. Eliza dropped the letter beside her on the bed. Rose was engaged, was going to be married. The news shouldn't have come as such a surprise. Rose had spoken often of her hopes for the future, her desire for a husband and family, a grand house and a carriage of her own. And yet Eliza felt odd. She opened her new notebook and ran her fingers lightly over the first page, blistered by raindrops. She drew a line with her pencil, watched absently as it switched from dark to light, according to whether its base was damp or dry. She began a story, scribbled and scratched out for a time, before pushing the book aside. Finally, Eliza leaned back against her pillow. There was no denying it. She felt unusual. Something sat deep within her stomach, round and heavy, sharp and bitter. She wondered whether she had taken ill. Perhaps it was the rain.
Mary had often warned against staying outdoors too long. Eliza turned her head to look at the wall, at nothing. Rose, her cousin, hers to entertain, willing co-conspirator, was to be married. With whom would Eliza share the hidden garden, her stories, her life? How was it that a future so vividly imagined, years stretching ahead, filled with travel and adventure and writing, could prove so suddenly, so emphatically, a chimera? Her gaze slipped sideways to rest on the cold glass of the mirror. Eliza didn't often glance at the looking glass, and in the time that had elapsed since last she met her echo, something had gone missing. She sat up and moved closer, appraised herself. Realization came fully formed. She knew just what it was she'd lost. This reflection belonged to an adult. There was no place in its angles for Sammy's face to hide. He was gone. And now Rose was going too. Who was this man who had stolen her dearest friend in the blink of an eyelid? Eliza could not have felt so ill had she swallowed one of the Christmas decorations Mary made, one of the oranges spiked with cloves. Envy, that's what this lump was called. She envied the man who had made Rose well, who had done so easily what Eliza sought to do, who had caused her cousin's affections to shift so swiftly and completely. Envy. Eliza whispered the sharp word and felt its poisoned barbs prick the inside of her mouth. She turned away from the mirror and closed her eyes, willed herself to forget the letter and its awful news. She didn't want to feel envious, to harbor this barbed lump, for Eliza knew from her fairy tales the fate awaiting wicked sisters bewitched by envy. Chapter 35. The Blackhurst Hotel, 2005. Julia's apartment was at the very top of the house, accessed via an incredibly narrow set of stairs at the end of the second floor hallway. When Cassandra left her room, the sun had already begun to melt into the horizon, and the hall was now almost completely dark. She knocked and waited, tightening her grip on the neck of the bottle of wine she'd brought with her. A last-minute decision as she'd walked home with Christian through the village. The door opened, and Julia was there, wrapped in a shiny pink kimono. "Come, come," she said, gesturing for Cassandra to follow as she swept across the room. "I'm just titivating our dinner. Hope you like Italian."
"Love it," said Cassandra, hurrying behind.
What had once been a warren of tiny bedrooms housing an army of housemaids had been opened and reconfigured to create a large loft-style apartment. Dormer windows ran all the way along both sides and must have given incredible views across the estate during the day. Cassandra stopped at the entrance to the kitchen. Every surface was covered with mixing bowls and measuring cups, tomato tins with their lids hanging off, gleaming pools of olive oil and lemon juice, and other mysterious ingredients. For want of somewhere to put it, she held out her offering.
"Aren't you a darling?"
Julia popped the cork, then plucked a lone goblet from the rack above the bench, gurgled wine into it from a theatrical height. She licked a drop of Shiraz from her finger.
"Personally, I never drink anything but gin," she said with a wink. "Keeps you youthful. It's pure, you know."
She handed the goblet of sinful red liquid to Cassandra and swept from the kitchen.
"Now, come on in and make yourself comfortable."
She indicated an armchair in the center of the room, and Cassandra sat down. Before her was a wooden chest, doubling as a coffee table, and at its center sat a stack of old scrapbooks, each wearing a faded brown leather jacket. A shot of excitement spread quickly through Cassandra's body, and her fingertips tingled with desire.
"You sit and have a little flick through while I put the finishing touches to our dinner,"
Cassandra didn't need to be told twice. She reached for the top scrapbook and ran her palm ever so lightly over its surface. The leather had lost all hint of its grain and was smooth and soft as velvet. Inhaling her anticipation, Cassandra opened the cover and read, in a pretty and precise script, Rose Elizabeth Mountrachet Walker, 1909. She traced the words with a fingertip and felt the faint marks in the paper. Imagined the nibbed pen which had made them. Carefully, she turned the pages until she arrived at the first entry. A new year, and one in which such tremendous events are promised. I have barely been able to concentrate since Dr. Matthews arrived and gave me his verdict. I confess, the fainting spells of late had me gravely worried, and I was not the only one. I only needed a glance at Mama's face to see anxiety writ large across her features. While Dr. Matthews was examining me, I lay still, eyes focused on the ceiling, forcing my mind away from fear by recalling the happiest moments of my life so far. My wedding day, of course, my trip to New York, the summer Eliza first came to Blackhurst. How bright such memories seem when the life they catalogue is threatened. Afterwards, when Mama and I sat side by side on the sofa awaiting Dr. Matthews's diagnosis, her hand reached for mine. It was cold. I glanced at her, but she would not meet my eyes. It was then that I began to worry in earnest. Through all my childhood ailments, Mama was the one to keep a positive mind. I wondered why her confidence had now deserted her, what it was she had intuited that gave her cause for such concern. When Dr. Matthews cleared his throat, I squeezed Mama's hand and waited. What he said, though, was more shocking than anything I could have dreamed. "You are with child. 2 months gone, I'd say. God willing, you will deliver in August." Oh, but are there words to explain the joy those words provoked? After so long hoping, the terrible months of disappointment. A baby to love, an heir for Nathaniel, a grandchild for Mama, a godchild for Eliza. Cassandra's eyes stung. To think that this baby whose conception Rose celebrated was Nell, this desperately wanted baby in waiting, was Cassandra's dear, displaced grandmother. Rose's hopeful sentiments were especially moving, written as they were in ignorance of all that would come afterwards. She flicked quickly through the journal pages, past snippets of lace and ribbon, brief notes reporting doctor's visits, invitations to various dinners and dances around the county, until finally, in December 1909, she found what she was looking for. "She is here. I make this record a little later than expected. The past months have been more difficult than anticipated, and I have had little time or energy for writing, but all has been worth it. After so many months of hoping, long spells of illness and worry and confinement, I hold in my arms my darling child. Everything else fades away. She is perfect, her skin so pale and creamy, her lips so pink and plump. Her eyes are a deep blue, but the doctor says that is always so, and they may darken with time. Secretly, I hope he is wrong. I wish for her the true Mountrachet colouring, like father and Eliza, blue eyes and red hair. We have decided to name her Ivory. It is the colour of her skin, and, as time will doubtless prove, her soul." "Here we are." Julia was juggling two steaming bowls of pasta and had an enormous pepper mill tucked beneath her arm. "Ravioli with pine nuts and gorgonzola." She handed one to Cassandra. "Careful, the plate's a bit warm." Cassandra took the proffered bowl and set the scrapbook aside. "Smells delicious."
If I hadn't become a writer, then a renovator, then a hotelier, I'd have been a chef. Cheers.
Julia lifted her glass of gin, took a sip, then sighed. I sometimes feel my entire life is a series of accidents and chances. Not that I'm complaining. One can be very happy having relinquished all expectation of control. She speared a ravioli square. But enough about me. How goes it at the cottage?
Really well, said Cassandra. Except the more I do, the more I realize needs doing. The garden's quite wild, and the house itself is a mess. I'm not even sure it's structurally sound. I suppose I should have a builder come and look at it for me, but I haven't had time yet. There's been so much else to keep me busy. It's all very overwhelming?
Yeah, it's definitely overwhelming. But more than that, it's...
Cassandra paused, searched for the right word, surprised herself when she found it.
Exciting. I've found something at the cottage, Julia.
Found something? Her brows shot up. As in, hidden treasure something?
If you like your treasure green and fertile.
Cassandra bit her bottom lip. It's a hidden garden. A walled garden at the back of the cottage. I don't think anyone's been inside for decades, and no wonder. The walls are really high, completely covered by brambles. You'd never guess it was there.
How did you find it?
By accident, really.
Julia shook her head. No such thing as accidents.
I honestly had no idea it was there.
I'm not suggesting that you did. I'm just saying perhaps the garden only hid from those it didn't wish to see.
Well, I'm certainly glad it showed itself to me. The garden is incredible. It's really overgrown, but underneath the brambles, all kinds of plants have survived. There are paths, garden seats, bird feeders.
Like Sleeping Beauty, fast asleep until the enchantment is broken.
That's the thing, though. It hasn't been asleep. The trees have kept growing, bearing fruit, even though there's been no one there to appreciate it. You should see the apple tree. It looks to be 100 years old.
It is, said Julia suddenly, sitting upright and pushing her bowl aside.
Or it very nearly is.
She flicked through the scrapbooks, running her finger down page after page, turning back and forth.
Aha! She said, tapping an entry. Here it is. Just after Rose's 18th birthday, before she went to New York and met Nathaniel.
Julia propped a pair of turquoise and mother-of-pearl glasses on the end of her nose and began to read.
21st of May, 1907. What a day it has been. And to think when it started I thought I was to suffer yet another interminable day inside. After Dr. Matthews mentioned a few cases of sniffles in the village, Mama has become terrified that I will fall ill and jeopardize the country weekend we are to attend next month. Eliza, as always, had other ideas. Just as soon as Mama had left by carriage for Lady Fillimore's luncheon, she appeared at my door, cheeks aglow. How I envy her the time she spends out of doors, and insisted that I put aside my scrapbook, for I was working on you, dear diary, and come with her through the maze. There was something there that I must see. My first